WNHNLP 94.7 FM in Concord, streaming at WNHNFM.org. You are listening to Statehouse Watch. I'm Arnie Alpert.
And I'm Maggie Fogarty. We're coming to you from the American Friends Service Committee's New Hampshire program in our Zoom studios now, in what I think is week 10 of our response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
The virus crisis, it keeps going, and our newsletter, Statehouse Watch, keeps going. Even while the Statehouse is not meeting in regular session, we continue to put out a weekly newsletter every Friday. You can subscribe to it by going to our website at afsc.org/NH and just look for the subscribe button, and it will come to you in your inbox on Friday.
And there still is plenty to report on, even though our legislature hasn't been nearly as active as they would be. These would have been very busy weeks as they finished their work on the many hundreds of bills that were offered in January of this year and the bills that were carried over from the previous session. But tracking the state's response and now different phases of reopening and the flow of dollars, federal dollars, to various sectors of the economy finds us with a lot to report on.
Maggie, I think we both heard from contact in the legislature that they are likely to just drop lots of the bills or pretty much anything that's not directly related to the COVID crisis. Is that what you've heard?
It has. And that's quite sad, as there were many positive proposals in the works this year that I don't think could be justified as directly related to the COVID crisis. So I imagine that legislators will be starting to plan to bring those bills back in the next session.
Well, right. And that means that they've got to start thinking about elections already. In fact, the filing period for candidacies to run for state rep and state senate, as well as governor and other offices, opens up very soon in June. So we go very quickly from a legislative season into an election season. But the legislature does need to wrap up its business. And what was very interesting in the calendar last week, the Speaker of the House announced that the House will meet again, but not at the State House. They're going to meet in the Whittemore Arena at the University of New Hampshire in Durham, a facility that is large enough for the 400 members of the legislature to be spaced in a safe manner from each other. They will all be issued an N95 mask. They will have their temperatures checked. And I guess, as the speaker also noted, because UNH is a gun-free zone, they'll be told not to bring their guns with them into the arena.
Do you have any information about how voting will happen? Will they be creating the electronic systems such as what they use in the House chamber?
One of the interesting dynamics, Maggie, is that the speaker has talked about spending a bunch of money so that they can create a new mobile electronic system that they can bring with them. The minority leader, Dick Hinch, has objected to that, but I expect that that is what is going to happen.
And what about who will be making the decisions about which bills?
I'm going to guess that that will be something that will happen in the leadership, that all the other bills will probably get tabled, and then they will just die on the table at the end of the year. That's my guess right now. Meanwhile, over in the state Senate, there is nothing that is going on that is visible, although Senate President Donna Soucy has said that the Senate will reconvene possibly on the same day that the House does, and probably in Representatives Hall, which, while it is too small of a facility for 400 representatives to be spaced 6 feet apart, is large enough easily for 24 senators to meet there safely. So that's what we are expecting to happen, although when exactly that will be has not yet been announced.
Well, that certainly makes a lot of sense.
On Friday, the governor had one of his regular news conferences, this time announcing that he has a plan now to spend $595 million coming out of the so-called CARES Act funds that are coming into the state. The total is $1.2 billion. The governor has convened a legislative advisory group and a so-called stakeholders advisory group. They've been meeting a lot and coming up with ideas for the governor. And in fact, even before the stakeholders had approved their recommendations, the governor came up with a plan. The centerpiece of it is $400 million to go in grants to New Hampshire businesses. Well, let's hear what the governor had to say.
To date, the state has received approximately $1.25 billion in coronavirus relief funds within the CARES Act, as well as many other dollars outside of that $1.25 billion for programs like the Department of Justice, for hospitals and healthcare, all with the mission of helping combat and recover from COVID-19. The team at Gopher met day in and day out and continues to do so with key stakeholders led by Jerry Little, their director. Has been a terrific team, and it's been an absolute honor to spend some time with them and bounce ideas. And I've seen and watched them work with the Legislative Advisory Board, with the Stakeholder Advisory Boards, in terms of not just receiving information, but really figuring out not just how much should go out, but how, what tools and what methods would we use to make sure that whatever gets done is done quickly and fair and an open and transparent process. They've really allowed the state to get a broad perspective of where relief should be focused. Their mission was to move fast, and that's why we're here today. We are talking about an allocation of an additional $595 million in committed funds for affected areas and industries across the state. Today, we're also putting forward $60 million to New Hampshire nonprofits to help mitigate the critical public health and economic impacts of the crisis on residents who rely on these nonprofits for so many of their daily needs, food, shelter, health care, educational supports, and other human services. This funding will move in a streamlined, very rapid manner to help organizations across the state, from the arts to human services, the nonprofit community, development organizations, so many others. The program is not designed to cover healthcare nonprofits. They're covered in the other programs, one of which we just spoke about. Childcare nonprofits, we're creating a separate fund for childcare, which we're going to talk about very shortly. And higher education institutions, we have another fund separate for the higher education. Technically, those are all nonprofits, but we're really focusing these dollars on the other nonprofits. There's thousands of them across the state, frankly, that provide a lot of the foundation and the services that so many folks have come to rely on. This is one of those areas where the original requested amount by the Legislative Advisory Board looked at $30 million. And a lot of one of my original ideas was to space out how this money was going to go. A little money today, a little money in a couple months, a little money down the road, always trying to manage where those needs might be. One area with nonprofits and businesses, we came to the real conclusion that the apex of need is now. It really is. We are taking steps to slowly open the economy and get things going. That's going to take some time, we know. But to be sure, the apex of need is today. Next, we have the Main Street Relief Fund. This is a large fund. It is a $400 million fund. It's a pretty staggering number at the state level. But when you consider the PPP program, a very important program, just injected well over $2 billion into the state for a lot of our businesses, and that just started to hit the surface. We know that the $400 million isn't necessarily going to cover all the bases, but what we are trying to do is make sure that in a fair, open, and very equitable way, businesses really have the opportunity to do the basic things, pay their bills, pay their mortgages, pay their property taxes, things of that nature, so that even if they are in a position where they have to close or have been closed, if they are in a position where they're having trouble getting workers, getting back to work, and they have to stay closed for a little longer, it's not driving them into a bankruptcy position. It's not driving them to fully close their business. It really is to provide that relief, not necessarily stimulus, that's a little different, but actually relief to help these businesses survive and recover, hopefully in a growing economy in the future. This initial round of $400 million will obviously help small business get through all these disruptions. So starting today and ending on May 29th, 2020, small businesses interested in receiving funds have to fill out the pre-grant application through the Department of Revenue Administration. That application is really going to allow us to account for businesses' anticipated lost revenues due to COVID and any other federal assistance a business may have received, like through the Federal Paycheck Protection Program or other federal programs that might be out there. Any eligible business interested in applying for the funds has to fill out the pre-grant application. And after the two-week period is over, the Department of Revenue Administration will look at the data and work with in determining a final fair and simple formula that'll guarantee any small business that qualifies. So anyone that qualifies will receive a check from the state. So one thing we're trying to avoid is a first come, first serve. That's not the situation here at all. If you qualify, you will get funds.
All right. So we heard a lot of amounts and different important categories for investments. I didn't hear really any information about the criteria that will be used. So I wonder if the governor will be deferring to each sector to determine how best to utilize these dollars.
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the applications are going to go to the Division of Revenue Administration, and the governor seemed to say that after the applications are in, they will look at the data and then create some type of system to decide how the information or how the money can be allocated in a way that is fair and transparent. So an interesting situation. And Maggie, meanwhile, there's $60 million being set aside for nonprofit organizations. That's not including the hospitals and daycare centers that have their own pots of money, but other nonprofits, service providing agencies that certainly are struggling right now and in need. But it sounds like the three agencies, the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation, the New Hampshire Center for Nonprofits, and the Community Development Finance Authority will be developing the criteria for how that $60 million gets divvied up. It hasn't been set up yet. So it's an interesting thing. The governor seems eager to get the money out and working, but they're making their announcements before they're even ready to figure out how the needs are going to get assessed and who's going to get the checks.
So it will be important at some point to see where all the dollars went and if it's possible to have some record of the impact that they had.
Well, we certainly will want to know that. And in fact, there still is an ongoing discussion about the governor's authority to act in this unilateral fashion, the normal checks and balances that come through, for example, the work of the Joint Fiscal Committee at the State House and certainly the Executive Council. These are the bodies that normally have to vote to approve the expenditure of funds, certainly in large quantities like this. We'll talk more about that in a little while with Executive Counselor Andrew Volinsky here today on State House Watch.
And then we'll also be talking with Victoria Adewomi, who has not only worked for 8 years in the public health field in Manchester, but she's a board member for the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute.
Spring turning into summer. It's a time when people want to be outside and interacting. It's also a time for graduation.
That's right. We had a graduation in our own household in the last few days. So we're very aware of this moment.
Well, I guess it's a time for changes.
Oh, yeah. And my time was running wild in me in dead-end streets. And every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. So I turned myself to face me. But I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't wanna be a richer man.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. It's gonna have to be a different man. Sides, but never leave the stream of warm and permanent sand. So the days float through my eyes, but still the days seem the same. And these children that you spit on as they try to change their worlds are immune to your consultations. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Don't tell them to blow up and out of it.
Changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes.
Where's the shame you've left us up to her next to me? Time may change me, but you can't twist time. Strange fascination, fascinating.
Changes are taking the face I'm going.
I'm Arnie Alpert, and you are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHNLP, and I am in the Zoom studio with Executive Counselor Andy Volinsky. Welcome back to Statehouse Watch.
Hi, Arnie. I'm in a different Zoom studio. Good to see you.
We're just a few miles away. We are physically distant. We are socially and electronically connected, and that's be what we're getting used to. I'm curious about the operation of the Executive Council, which has now been meeting remotely for a couple of months. And I'm curious if you could just say a word about how that process is going.
The Executive Council has stuck to its original schedule. And so we have met by using the state's phone system. There are five counselors, the governor, maybe 20 department heads, and someone curates the discussion. It's a little cumbersome, but it works pretty well. And I checked. The system can accommodate 500 people. And so I've suggested on a couple of occasions that maybe the Senate should use the state system so it can meet.
Yeah, it's interesting that the House is finding ways for committees to have executive sessions and work sessions and has announced a full House session to take place on June 11th in the Whittemore Arena of all places. But the Senate, while it is saying that they do plan to meet in June, not announced any details and has no committee meeting. So it's kind of a curious thing going on right now, but I guess it's not the role of the Executive Council to tell the legislative branch what they ought to be doing. It is the job of the Executive Council in normal times to be approving contracts that the state is letting out.
Look, I think the five counselors and the governor all have the best interests of the residents of our state in mind. There's a lot of different kinds of expertise and experience on the council. We have different backgrounds. And unfortunately, the governor has completely cut us out of any participation in deciding how to distribute CARES Act COVID-19 response money. That's $1.25 billion, except the governor didn't realize that all that money went into the state's treasury and that he can't remove it unless the council specifically consents. So that came to a head at our last meeting.
I understand that by a 4-1 vote, which means that it was not a partisan vote entirely, the council said, no, we're not going to let you spend a bunch of money that you would like to spend, and it's been put off till the upcoming meeting. So what are you expecting to take place this coming Wednesday that will be different than what happened at your last meeting?
Well, the governor's held a couple of press conferences where he's shared some information with the public about how he and his advisory committee would like to spend the $1 billion. It's clear to me that their plans are not yet complete. And what concerns me is when we were asking for information, you know, I sent the governor a letter about 10 days before our last council meeting asking for the details of the plans. It has become apparent to me that the governor did not yet know how he was going to spend the money. So in large part, he didn't have plans. And I think he was just a little embarrassed to admit that he did not yet know what he was going to do, but still wanted us to release the money to him.
I thought I read that he had sent you a 2-page letter and he thought that that was quite adequate.
Yeah, you know how when we were in math class in school and the teacher said, show your work so that at least you get partial credit, even though you might get the answer wrong? There was no opportunity for partial credit. He gave us 2 pages. It showed some gross amounts. There were no details, no explanation. It was not. It was $1 billion at issue.
Wow. I would pocket change. So
yeah. So and even with his 2 pages of the billion, he left $175 million without any detail whatsoever. He just said, give us this as a cushion. And, you know, a little bit of a cushion, a couple of million dollars makes sense, but 20% of the overall Treasury warrant was kind of ridiculous. But as I said, yesterday, the governor announced $400 million for a Main Street relief package. But when you go to the website and you read the details, they don't yet know the criteria they will use to make the grants to Main Street businesses. They say that on the website. It's, again, clear to me that the governor just didn't know anything at the last meeting and therefore could not tell us. And I'm not faulting him for that, except for his lack of transparency. He could have just said, I don't know how I'm going to spend $1 billion, but would you give me the authority anyway? The answer from four of us, three Dems and one Republican, would have been, come back when you're ready. And that's still my position. I mean, I'm not going to shut down the state and not spend any money during June out of a political fight with the governor. But it is telling that the governor doesn't trust us enough to develop his plan, share it with us, and then ask for us to approve it. It's really a violation of how government is established and intended to run.
Well, certainly in this state, transparency is one of the popular words that he uses at his news conferences. So he does believe, or at least asserts, that he is being transparent. But I'm curious about a couple of contracts or projects in particular, Councillor Volinsky. One that's gotten some attention is the contract with ConvenientMD for doing COVID-19 testing in the state. Now, that's money that has already been spent because the testing is taking place. The company that is involved in this was founded by people who are donors to the governor's political campaign. Now, I have not heard any criticism of their work, but I certainly have heard questions about whether this is appropriate or whether this type of contract should be taking place without the normal checks and balances that we see either through the Executive Council or through the Fiscal Committee or generally both. Have you seen the details of the ConvenientMD contract?
I have not. It was a no-bid contract awarded solely by the governor. But that's not the only thing. The governor also gave more than $1 million grant to ConvenientMD. And when I expressly asked about the rationale for the grant, the governor said, you don't vote on it, you don't get to know what the rationale was.
Well, I think that this is disturbing. And again, the work, it is a legitimate crisis. So I understand the inclination to get the money to work as quickly as possible in places where it's needed, particularly protect the health and safety of people in New Hampshire. But the lack of ability to have scrutiny and checks and balances on this, particularly in sensitive political matters, is definitely startling. Now, you've also been expressing concern about the way in which education money is getting spent. Could you say a little bit about that?
Frank Edelblue, the Commissioner of Education, basically has been given complete discretion in how he distributes almost $50 million. Unlike other states' education commissioners, he's decided to team up with Betsy DeVos and use a plan that gives a bunch of this CARES Act money to private schools to the detriment of public schools in those communities. So let me say that again. If you're in Manchester and you have private schools in Manchester, which you do, the private schools get a share of the CARES Act money on a per student basis, regardless of whether the private schools take kids in poverty or not.
Does that include religious schools?
Yes.
And that's something that has been explicitly barred, I believe, by our state Supreme Court in the past. Is that not the case? You're the lawyer in this interview.
Yeah, it's not quite as concrete as that. And to be frank, in the ordinary way this money would be distributed, public schools could provide equitable services for kids in poverty who happen to go to religious schools. So if they need extra tutoring
Do you mean private schools could provide?
No, the public school can give it to the private school kid. So if you have
All right.
If you have a child going to a local parish school and the child is of a certain income level and the public school has an after-school program, the private school child could attend. And that's perfectly fine. But what the DeVos Edelblue plan does, it says don't base it on the kids in poverty who attend a private school. Give them a full share whether they're in poverty or not. So under this plan, unless they turn it down, St. Paul's, Exeter, Bishop Girton, all those schools could get full allotments of CARES Act money from the state of New Hampshire. And there are states like Indiana where the state commissioner of education said, we're not doing this. This is wrong. It breaks with tradition on how we distribute these funds. We're only doing the poverty-based distribution method.
Is it your position that that is wrong or that it is actually illegal?
I think both, because the guidance authored by Betsy DeVos is at odds with Congress's intent. And it's the congressional law that governs, not the hijacking of those funds by DeVos and Edelblue.
Andy Volinsky, when you ran for executive council, one campaign pledge you made was that you would not sue the state while you were holding office. I'm curious if you are regretting that pledge right now.
I'm not regretting it. I'm working hard against type not to default to the legal issues too quickly. I think a lot of these are political matters. And, you know, the reason I ran is because we couldn't solve school funding through litigation. It requires political leadership. And so I'm focused on providing that kind of leadership.
Well, meanwhile, the executive council, I assume, still has its normal business to do of approving non-COVID related contracts and approving appointments by the governor. Is that business going forward?
Yes, that's business as usual. Our sessions take a little bit longer than normal because everything has to be a roll call vote because we're all separated. But it's not been difficult. I mean, we get 80 to 100 contracts to consider and approve. We probably have less than the normal number of appointments, but we're still getting them and taking them up in the normal course.
One of the contracts that we've had our eye on is the contract between the state and the State Employees Association, the largest union representing state workers, that came out of a fact finder months and months ago with recommendations. The union has said that they would go along with the recommendation of the fact finder as a compromise, but apparently the governor has been unwilling to put that on the council's agenda. Is that still where we're at?
It is still where we are at. I raised it two meetings ago. The Commissioner of Administrative Services, Charlie Arlinghouse, answered a number of questions about the contract and the process. And here's what came out of it. The commissioner has someone on his staff called the Director of Personnel. She's being excluded from the negotiations, and the governor's hand-picked former director is conducting the negotiations. His name is Matt Newlands. He's got a terrible style, terrible relationship with the employees' union. He's there to keep things from getting to agreement, not to resolve disputes, and he's there because the governor has put him there. Now, let me add one thing. When Newland left the state service position, he went to the university system. And it is legitimate to ask why the university system hired a guy like this, who's a union buster. And second, why they're paying him his full salary and lending him to the governor to interfere with state negotiations.
Well, certainly those are good questions. I'm curious, as this goes forward, as we go into this crisis, what are you hearing from people who are in the state workforce in terms of health and safety in the workplaces? Obviously, our state workers are essential, and I'm curious if they are getting the protection that they need to keep doing their work for us.
I think the way to characterize it is that it's highly uneven. Some agencies have done well from the start with social distancing and protective gear. Other agencies, you almost had to push and complain and shove and re-complain to get them to do things that you would have expected them to do in the first instance. So it's uneven. But let me give you an example of the contract negotiations and the governor's favoritism. The governor approved a Teamsters contract at the state prison that covers the correctional officers. So they got a raise, and then after they do, I think it's 2 overtime shifts, they get double time instead of time and a half. Their supervisors, the sergeants, lieutenants, captains, work side by side with them, but they're represented by the state employees union with whom the governor has a beef. And he won't approve the same pay increase or the same overtime protections. So it's turned out that a number of the correctional officers are now earning more than their experienced supervisors, which is not a good situation, because if that continues, the supervisors will leave for better treatment in other jobs. And the reason everyone's working so much overtime is we can't find enough people to staff the prisons. So this is not a good situation.
And that was before we had a COVID-19 outbreak, where prisons are among the most risky places for the people who are living there, the prisoners, as well as for the workers. Just yesterday, Andy, we heard that one of the workers at the Stafford County Jail in Dover has been tested positive. That's a facility that, in addition to housing county inmates, also houses immigrants detained by ICE pending deportation proceedings. We've been calling for months now for immigrants to be released. We've also been joining the ACLU and others in calling for depopulation of the state prison system to the extent that's possible, consistent with public safety. We've not heard back from a letter to the governor about that, and I'm curious whether those are issues in which you, as an executive counselor, are able to add any weight.
It's in part as an elected official, but also as a human being and a humanist. I asked the governor particularly about the Stafford County situation the meeting before last, and his answer was that it wasn't on his radar screen and he was unaware of the situation. I don't know how that could be, but that is what he said. I intend to raise it again at this meeting on Wednesday to see if maybe he recognized there's an issue there. Maybe you know the answer to this. I spoke to an immigration attorney maybe 3 weeks ago who told me that immigrants were still being transported to Boston for hearings, interacting with court and lockup personnel there, and then being brought back after those hearings.
Yeah, I think that was the case. That, I believe, has been suspended for video proceedings, but there is still the possibility of other immigrants who are being brought into the facility late in the week and then shipped out again a couple days later. So there may still be people coming in and out of there, and that's something that we try to have attention to. But meanwhile, there is an American Civil Liberties Union class action lawsuit proceeding in federal court that has already led to the release of a number of individuals. So there is certainly attention on that taking place. You are listening to Statehouse Watch on WNHN. Our guest today is Andrew Volinsky, who is a member of the Executive Council. Andy, long before you ever ran for office or perhaps even thought about running for office, you were representing a fellow named Jimmy Meters, who was accused of homicide in Georgia and found guilty and sentenced to death. That is giving you, I'm sure, some special insight into the system of justice, if we could even call it that, in Glynn County, Georgia. I wonder if you might offer a few words about that right now in light of the case of Ahmaud Arbery, who was shot and killed there.
Yes. I represented Jimmy Meters for 30 years until we won a commutation of his death sentence 5 hours before his scheduled execution in January. And so for 30 years, I've periodically visited Brunswick, Georgia in Glynn County. For much of that case, my opposing counsel was the DA's office there. And so I know the personnel. I've interacted with the sheriff's office there. Glynn County is an awful place. It includes hugely wealthy barrier islands with big mansions. And then you drive across the causeway to the mainland, and it's full of tar paper shacks and the most depressing poverty I've seen. This Arbery case is one in which the local DA slowed down the arrest and potential prosecution of her former investigator who was involved in shooting Mr. Arbery, who was unarmed, apparently out for a Sunday afternoon jog. But that's not the only case. This area was the subject of an Ira Glass expose about the drug court being misused by the local judges to basically commit probationers to involuntary servitude. It's also the place where, in a domestic violence matter, the very prosecutor against Jimmy Metters intervened on behalf of a cop who was abusing his wife and child. This is a place where I do not expect justice to happen. And it is a sad representation of America that these places still exist.
Oh, or perhaps that justice won't happen all by itself, but with the type of scrutiny that at least this case is getting, the attention that you have given in the Jimmy Metters case, it took decades, but at least some degree of justice was attained in the end. So that's what we can count on and continue to call for as this case goes forward. Andrew Olinsky, I want to thank you so much for your time and for being with us today on Statehouse Watch. Stay safe out there.
Arnie, it's always great to see you. Be well.
You are listening to Statehouse Watch Radio. I'm Maggie Fogarty from the American Friends Service Committee, and I'm in our Zoom studio again this week with a friend and colleague, Victoria Adewami from the Board of Directors of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute. Welcome, Victoria.
Thank you so much for having me, Maggie.
So this is your first time on Statehouse Watch Radio. So do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, your professional, personal life, whatever you want to share?
Absolutely. So first of all, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited about the conversation we're about to have. For me, I am in public health in Manchester. I've been a public servant for just about 8 years at this point. I also, and this is how me and Maggie have been able to get so close, have had many years of getting to support immigrant and refugee organizations in New Hampshire. And I'm born and raised in Hooksett, New Hampshire. And so I definitely feel just so keenly how important it is our state is successful with the shared power, brilliance of every one of our citizens. And I know that that's dear to your heart as well. So again, thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you, Victoria. And I appreciate you making time for this interview. In the field of public health, obviously, everyone is beyond maxed out as we respond to this crisis in big cities like Manchester and statewide. So thanks for making the time. We've been wanting to talk to you since we saw on May 3rd that the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute had issued an important report. We track their reports closely, often related to budget and other, you know, kind of fiscal policy issues in New Hampshire. This one is entitled COVID-19 Crisis Affects Greater on Racial and Ethnic Minority Populations in New Hampshire. So can you tell us how this report was done? And then, of course, we want to hear what the key findings are.
Of course. So I can say I'm a little bit biased because I am on the board, but I think the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute is doing some of the most critical research and analysis about many, many issues affecting our state, especially our low to middle income populations. So this report has definitely been born out of that real sense that as we all kind of grapple with the fallout of COVID-19 in different ways, it's impacted every single one of us in some form or fashion. There are specific populations that are bearing the brunt of what's happening in terms of hospitalizations, infection rates, and deaths more than other communities, and really wanting to understand why that is. And so that is the spirit and the birthplace of this report.
Excellent. Well, it appears to be well-researched, as all of the NHFPI work is. What is described in the report as the outcomes of this study?
I would say the lead of this report is that while people of color make up about 10% of the population in New Hampshire, they're making up about 21% of the confirmed cases, 18% of the hospitalizations, and 10% of the deaths. And so really that means that communities of color are more likely than white communities to be impacted and infected with coronavirus and hospitalized because of the virus.
And what are some of the reasons for this?
I think that there are many factors that play a role here. I probably won't touch on all of them, but just based on what we know from the report and also what we're seeing nationally, that the higher population density is definitely playing a role. So we know more than half of our minority communities live in Southern New Hampshire, Nashua, Manchester, and these are some of the most densely populated areas of the state. Overcrowding in terms of housing is definitely a factor. In Manchester specifically, we know, and this is anecdotally, right, from my work in the city, we know in some of our housing units that are doubled up, we have multiple people sharing one or two rooms, right? And that situation just doesn't allow for social distancing, doesn't allow for those kinds of measures that we know are critical to stopping the spread of the virus. Another huge factor, as we really understand what's at play here, is the economics of COVID-19. So people of color are represented and overrepresented, unfortunately, in our poverty statistics as a state. So the rate of poverty for those identifying as Black or Hispanic Latino in New Hampshire is more than double, right, the rate of those who identify as white non-Hispanic. And so populations of color nationally as well also have lower access to healthcare and rates of insurance coverage, yet, right, are more likely to be part of that essential workforce. We are more likely, as a person of color myself, to be the bus drivers, the restaurant workers, people in other public places where the viral load is greater and therefore the chance of contraction is higher. These industries at the same time often offer fewer benefits such as sick time. And if your critical income is dependent on your job, the fear of losing that can often lead individuals to continue working despite having unsafe conditions and higher infection rates. And then just the last thing that I have to touch on is really the comorbidities that we know are driving so much of how the virus impacts individuals. So they would call this a crisis within the crisis, because this isn't something that started in January or February of this year when we knew Corona was on our heels as a nation. This is something that predates the pandemic, right? These are fault lines that exist in the infrastructure of our communities. Locally and nationally, communities of color often experience higher rates of chronic disease and premature death compared to whites, right? That's the data. So for example, people of African descent like myself, Asian Americans, and Native American populations are more likely to be diagnosed with diabetes, asthma, heart disease, all of these conditions that are associated with a higher risk of severe illness related to COVID-19. And again, I would really kind of draw a huge circle, star, highlight healthcare access in this conversation. It plays such a leading role. Compared to whites, Hispanics are more than three times likely to be uninsured. African Americans are almost twice as likely to be uninsured. And these are populations that are also more likely to report not being able to see a doctor because of cost.
These are heart-wrenching, tragic consequences for, as you rightly point out, systemic failures, systemic discrimination, and systemic vulnerabilities. And as you say, we are seeing this play out nationally It's very helpful to see it confirmed as a reality in New Hampshire. And one has to hope that as we see and understand these impacts, that we would then, you know, by being informed, then be moved to take steps to address these interlocking crises of housing affordability, poverty, healthcare access, lack of adequate protections for workers in vulnerable situations. So does the report kind of direct us toward some of these solutions?
So absolutely. I would say, and not just the report, I feel like the body of literature within public health, so many of our experts are really saying the same thing, which is really affirming to me that we do have some clear ideas about what we can be doing to reduce what we're seeing. And so I think increasing access is so huge. Again, we mentioned healthcare in this conversation. Increasing access to healthcare, that means better housing opportunities for folks, enhanced economic and family supports, which can give people of color and all people really options to be able to follow the current recommendations, i.e. getting tested and staying home if you feel sick. In that same place, I think we can't talk about increasing access without reducing barriers. And so when we think about language, for example, for limited English speaking populations, cost, implicit bias and racial discrimination, like you mentioned, Maggie, those are all barriers that make health access and access to testing, right, more difficult for already vulnerable populations. And so how can we work harder as a people to identify what those barriers are and increasing access when and where we see it?
So there's important work to be done. And right now there are funds flowing to the state from Congress. There are important actions being taken here at the state level. It seems clearly that more could be done. I'm gratified to see that I believe it's the New Hampshire Public Health Association and the Office of Health Equity are gathering people to lift up these public health concerns and the equity implications of this crisis. So we would certainly hope at AFSC that people are organized and mobilized to insist on these kinds of responses. Yeah. We hopefully have more will to do this than we've had in the past.
Absolutely. And if I could say just one more thing, Maggie, I really think, and this is maybe less flashy of an idea, but we often talk about real data in public health. So real stands for racial, ethnic, and linguistic. And we really believe, you know, we often say you can't change what you don't measure. So we have to be just so concerned that we're collecting that accurate data that really impacts and makes our interventions accurate, right? We need to understand how communities of color are being impacted by this pandemic. And that really gives us the power to be able to find those best interventions to keep all of our communities alive and well.
Excellent point. Excellent point. I agree. Well, Victoria Adewumi, thank you very much. Why don't you tell people where they can find this report and track the other good work of the New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute?
Absolutely. I would encourage your listeners to visit www.nhfpi.org. You'll find not just this powerful piece of analysis, but many, many others. And another thing about our incredible reports is that as data becomes more available, they're constantly being updated. And so if there is an issue that you're especially concerned with or curious about, definitely continue to visit, because there are always kind of up to the minute or best data available reporting that's happening. So that would be my encouragement for your listeners.
Very good. Thank you, Victoria.
My name is Tess George. I'm from Nashua, New Hampshire. I am here for my sixth rally in support of the civilly detained immigrants in Stratford County Jail.
I'm from State House Watch Radio. Do you want to say a word about why you've come here every week?
Sure. My name is Mary Provencal Fogarty. I am 18 years old. I live in Dover, New Hampshire. And I think it's a public health crisis to keep people in detention during a pandemic. I see very little excuses for continuing their custody with ICE. And we just saw in the news, like I was just saying, that there have been confirmed cases for a detainee and a staffer, which just raises the alarms even more that whatever testing is happening has to be amplified to a larger degree. And I valued coming to these because I have seen people through the windows, knocking on the windows and holding up signs, and it's touched my heart. It's moved me a lot and made me feel like what we're doing here is important in some way. So.
I want us to have a moment of silence to honor the millions of migrants and the children of migrants in this country right now who are having to live in fear, who are having to live in the shadows. The thousands, the tens, the hundreds of thousands who are in prisons right now, who are in ICE detention centers, against their human rights, in violation of their human rights. And not only for that, I want us to hold in our hearts the millions who are held in prisons in our country right now. We have the highest incarceration rate in the entire world. We're going to have a moment of silence.
Hello, everybody. My name is Sebastian Fuentes, and I just want to tell you guys how thankful I am that all of you guys are here today. You guys got better things to do. But you're choosing to be here today. I certainly don't speak for all the immigrants in New Hampshire, but I'm speaking for myself. And I'm telling you that I'm so proud to see each one of you here today. A few years back, I could easily be the one behind bars right there. A few years back, I was one of those guys that was afraid to take the bus because I was afraid the ICE agents were gonna come up and take me. A few years ago, I was afraid to even call my family and tell them where I was exactly. A few years ago, I was afraid to see law enforcement. The same law enforcement that is supposed to protect me, I was afraid of them because of retaliation and fear that they're gonna do something to me because of my skin color or my accent. But here I am. I'm a US citizen now. Woo! And I know for a fact that after this rally, I'm gonna go home, I'm gonna take care of my children, I'm gonna do the homework with my children, I'm gonna put them in bed, but those guys behind bars, they won't be able to do so. None of them. So here you are, guys, fighting for them, to give them a voice. And I'm so proud, once again, to be here with you. Thank you very much, muchas gracias. I wanna see you guys next weekend here, please, thank you.
It's really important that these car rallies hosted by Never Again Action are continuing. That was week 6 yesterday, and they're hoping for an increasing turnout over the Sundays to come. This issue is even more urgent now as we've learned that a staff member at the Stafford County Jail has tested positive for COVID, as well as an immigrant in ICE custody who arrived to the facility late last week as part of the transfers that continue to happen from other detention centers in the region. This dynamic is something we have been raising our voices against for many weeks. It makes it impossible, even with thoughtful protocols at the jail, it makes it impossible to prevent the arrival of COVID-19 to the facility, putting everyone in danger. So the class action lawsuit continues with leadership from the ACLU and strong support from at least 4 other law firms, making their arguments to Judge McCafferty that ICE is willfully disregarding the well-being of people in its custody. So some important consultations this week with the judge. She expects ICE to show much greater effort and attention to the safety of people that they are insisting on keeping in custody. So we'll be watching that closely and hoping that our members of Congress who have yet to say anything about this publicly, that they will see that that they need to be on the right side of this and to object. As federal officials, they need to object directly to ICE for the ongoing detention of people, civil detentions of people during a pandemic. Completely unnecessary. You've been listening to Statehouse Watch Radio with me, Maggie Fogarty, and my co-host Arnie Alpert on WNHNLP. Visit WNHNFM.org for podcasts of all of our past shows, as well as Fred Portnoy's Ancient and Modern, The Attitude with Arnie Arneson, Portraits in Blue and Green with Frank Wilner, and The Dave Scott Show. Join us again next week, and remember, there's a bright side somewhere.
Well, there's a bright side somewhere. There's a bright side somewhere. And I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere, and there's more love somewhere, and there's more peace somewhere. I ain't gonna rest until I find it. There's a bright side somewhere. People got a good job somewhere. Got a lot of good friends somewhere. Got a little suitcase. Got a little family over on the bright side.